The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Hello everybody, this is Richard Martin from the Wake Up Call coming to you from Singapore, and it is the 24th of February 2012. And I thought that seeing as we're coming up against the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic, to be precise the 14th of April 1912, I thought it might be interesting to take a recent article from Charles Hugh Smith comparing that catastrophe with what's happening today. In an article entitled 10 Minutes After the Titanic Hit the Iceberg, he has this to say, and I quote, "In rewriting my next book, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, I hit upon what I think is an apt analogy to the present, 10 minutes after the Titanic hit the iceberg. As we all know, the unsinkable Titanic suffered a glancing collision with an iceberg on the night of April the 14th, 1912. In those first 10 minutes, it was not at all apparent that the mighty vessel had been fatally wounded, as there was no visible evidence of damage except to those below decks in the 6 watertight compartments, out of a total of 16, that had been damaged. But some rudimentary calculations soon revealed the truth to the officers. The ship could survive the first 4 watertight compartments being compromised, but not 5. Water would inevitably fill the 5th compartment and spill over into the 6th, and so on in a domino-like fashion until the ship sank. We can sympathize with the disbelief of the officers and with their confused reaction, both reassuring passengers and attempting to goad them into the lifeboats. As we know, with the mighty ship only slightly down by the bow and the interior still warm and bright with lights, it seemed far more dangerous to clamber into a lifeboat and drift into the cold Atlantic than it did to stay on board. As a result, the first lifeboats left the ship only partially full. Only when it became undeniable that the ship was doomed did people attempt to make other arrangements. But by then, it was too late. The tragedy was a cruel mix of human error, entering an ice field at nearly top speed, 23 to 25 knots, hubris-soaked planning, only enough lifeboats for half the passengers and crew, and design flaws. The high sulfur iron hull plating didn't bend when struck by the ice. It shattered like china, as did the rivets. I found this interesting engineering report on this material's failure. As noted above, the watertight compartment design was also flawed. Indeed, some studies have found that the ship would have lasted an additional 6 hours had there been no watertight compartments, as water would have sloshed evenly along the entire length of the vessel. I think this perfectly describes the present. Our financial system seems unthinkable. Yet the reliance on debt and financialization has already doomed it, whether we're willing to believe it or not. In effect, our expenses and new debt are rising at a rate far above the actual expansion of goods and services. This is like a household that increases its debt by 10% a year and its expenses by 6% a year, yet the household income is stagnant. Just as with the Titanic, default or insolvency are the only possible end states. We have no idea when the death spiral of financialization will gain speed and become undeniable. We know the status quo will pull out all the stops to maintain the illusion of growth, and that the rising debts of the central state, corporations, and consumer are unsustainable. They are not sustainable, and tricks will only extend and pretend to a certain point. Maybe the illusion that the ship is unsinkable can be maintained for another year or two, but we must note that the ship was visibly breaking up in late 2008. So the illusion of solvency, stability, and permanence has already been conjured for 4 long years at staggering expense. $2 trillion added to the federal balance sheet. $1.2 trillion in secret giveaways to the banking cartel. And $6 trillion in additional federal debt and spending, to name just a few of the costs. Those who anticipate the inevitable foundering will be better placed to survive and prosper. They will also be better placed to design a truly sustainable model after the corrupted financial and political systems dissolve in default or insolvency. Quite an adequate description, I would say, ladies and gentlemen, and one which you may like to bring forth in your travels and discussions with like-minded people. All right, let me give you my information, starting off with our toll-free number, 888-874-4888. Once again, the toll-free number to be used by all of you as and when you have the desire to share or participate in some way with company present. It is 888-874-4888. And if you would prefer instead to write in your emails, you can do that too. And the email address is rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin at GFAWD, which stands for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design, GFAWD.com. Once more, the email is open all the time, so as soon as it comes in, I will attempt to grab it and bring it to your attention. Once more, RM@GFAWD.com. And last but not least, my own personal direct line, which you can call any time during the week, and I will either pick up the phone or else take the phone message, which should include your name and your phone number. And please call 941. 941 is an area code in Sarasota. That's again 941-441-1682. Again, 941-441-1682. I'm gratified, pleased to note that there are more and more people who are indeed calling in. Hopefully I am able to lend a modicum of support and information to your problems and set you free in the knowledge that all will be well that ends well. All right, so now we come to the meeting, please, the meetup meeting this coming Sunday at 2 p.m., which will be held, as always, it's the sixth meeting of the Richard Martin Meetup Group, to be held in New Brunswick, which is to be found in New Jersey. And the meeting will be held, as usual, at the George Street Ale House at 378 George Street in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And I would be grateful, as always, if you would call our moderator, Susan, if you would like to come or get further information. And her number is 202-246-5131. That's Susan at 202-246-5131. She will have interesting information for you, and hopefully it will be an interesting few hours at 2 p.m. on Sunday. If you would like to come, please don't hesitate. Bring your friends. You know, we're talking about ways in which to help you manage the oncoming horrors of the Depression, which is already unleashing itself on a largely unsuspecting general public. It is, of course, predicated largely on how to leave the country. As I have mentioned on numerous occasions, this is truly the only solution which will enable you to extricate yourselves from really an ugly situation which is about to come down and meet us all. So please do feel free to come to New Brunswick on Sunday at 2 p.m. It was a lively discussion apparently at the last meeting in January, and promises to be the same this month as well. You know, I have to ask you why you personally think the price of gas is soaring. Some of you may have heard Nancy Pelosi, who said as follows: "We call on the Republican leadership to act on behalf of American consumers and join our efforts to crack down on speculators who care more about their profits than the price at the pump, even if these spikes harm the American consumer and our economy." Yep, this is the same old speculator nonsense we heard back when oil was trading at around $140 a barrel just before its collapse, the $36 in 2008. Well, how about it have something to do with the Obama government angling for another Mideast war over weapons of mass destruction that yet again do not exist? Might that perhaps have something to do with the soaring price of crude? Oh, and by the way, did you know that in January, the left-leaning Israeli Haaretz newspaper dropped its own atomic bombshell? Oh, yes. Apparently, Israeli intelligence agencies have worked up an intelligence assessment that Iran has not yet decided whether to begin a military program to construct a nuclear warhead. Put in other words, Mossad believes that there is no current Iranian nuclear weapons program. And Haaretz writes, and I quote, "The intelligence assessment Israeli officials will present later this week to Dempsey indicates that Iran has not yet decided whether to make a nuclear bomb. This Israeli view is that while Iran continues to improve its nuclear capabilities, it has not yet decided whether to translate these capabilities into a nuclear weapon, or more specifically, a nuclear warhead mounted atop a missile. Nor is it clear when Iran might make such a decision." End of quote. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is the same conclusion to which the 16 U.S. intelligence agencies have come to in 2007 and 2010. It is also consistent with what the Iranian government itself says, which is that the Iranian nuclear enrichment program is a civilian one and that Iran is not trying to construct a nuclear weapon. Likewise, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which continues to inspect Iranian nuclear facilities, has repeatedly and consistently stated that no nuclear material has been diverted from the civilian program. Yeah, you see, it's all just too inconvenient for these bloodthirsty warmongers, isn't it? You have to wonder, who exactly are the good guys and who are the villains in the world today? Is it possible, ladies and gentlemen, that you live among the villains? Is America the country you have chosen to live out your days in? You have got to wake up, my friends. Nobody else is going to talk to you like this. Nobody, not one person, anywhere, even on PRN. And it's not just America's pathetic attempts to maintain its feeble control over the world at large. How did the U.S. end up with expensive schools that can't teach? How did it end up with huge swaths of young mothers who aren't married? How did it end up with entire generations of people who won't and possibly can't work in the labor force? How did it end up with a skyrocketing prison population? The prison population in America has soared from less than 500,000 people in 1980 to more than 2.5 million people today. More than 7 million adults are in prison or on parole in the United States. The country has an incarceration rate that's 7 times higher than any other industrialized nation. How did the country end up with 72,536 pages of a tax code which exists because some corporate or union sponsor made campaign contributions to some member of Congress who piled on page after page? Well, there is something you can do on an individual level, ladies and gentlemen, if you live in the New York, New Jersey area. Go to the meetup on Sunday. And here's why young people need to leave the U.S. fast. The young are basically enslaved to the old. In effect, instead of families paying for their children's education, they force the children to borrow the money from the government. Then paying it back, the money is recycled to old people through Social Security, Medicare, and so forth. Meanwhile, the government borrows trillions more to fund their giveaway programs. In the United States, the total is over $15 trillion and rising. Most of it destined to pay benefits for people over the age of 50. And guess who's supposed to pay for all this debt? The young, of course. There is a way out. The airport departure gate. Well, if you go to the meetup on Sunday, you'll be given a helping hand. Again, Susan's number is 202-246-5131. Well, I came across this quote from the Council of Economic Advisers, or CEA, quote, "During the Great Depression, the only other instance of nationwide price decline since World War I, much of the comparably sized decline in nominal home prices was offset by a concurrent drop in general price levels. So the decline in real housing values was only about one quarter as large as the one we recently experienced." So you could say the current collapse in housing prices is a relative price shift, whereas the housing bust of the Great Depression was more a symptom of general price deflation in the economy. Sydney had this earlier to say in the week. 95%+ of mortgages today are being backed by Fannie and Freddie. Fannie and Freddie are effectively subsidizing unprofitable mortgages that the banks wouldn't put on their balance sheet. That is not sustainable. And ultimately, the taxpayer is paying a bill for it. The banks used to price profitable loans. And you know, there are a myriad of loan products that they're still not pricing for profits. From the recently released economic report of the president, and I quote, "We suspect the Great Depression housing bust didn't have the government props to soften the blow as we do today, which, therefore, on a relative basis, makes the current bust much worse. The prior conditions to the current bust must have been much worse than those before the Great Depression." Ladies and gentlemen, you are free to draw your own conclusions. Well, then I received an email from Kevin Moran as follows. "Back in ancient times, that is in the 1970s, the bankers had a formula that debt service for a mortgage, real estate taxes, and insurance could not exceed 28% of your monthly gross income, and the cost of all your other credit payments could not exceed an additional 8% for a total of 36%. In addition, they wanted 25% down payment, and you had to fund your real estate and an insurance escrow account at closing. As we all know, those conservative rules were disregarded in the 90s and early 2000s with the rise of CDOs. It's no surprise that housing prices have continued to fall. These are the important but complex questions. How many people have 25% to put down? Spoke to a client of mine who's an underwriter, and her lending company is requiring at least 25% down on every mortgage. How many people meet the 28 to 36% requirement? Demographics aside, the housing market will stabilize when these conditions are met." End of quote, and thank you very much for that, Kevin Moran. Well, you know, talking about real estate, people are clamoring to find out whether the real estate market has actually bottomed out. You know, ladies and gentlemen, I hate having to repeat myself, but I really do understand and sympathize with those who are concerned and worried. So let me just recap a bit and try to another tack here. Starting with the year 2001, just before the 9/11 World Trade Center attack, the real estate market had been riding a prolonged ascent, topping off with the bursting of the tech bubble. Free market forces said it was time to take a break. However, Greenspan said that was not acceptable, and he pumped prices straight up by providing easy credit. Around 2004, it became obvious that real estate was in bubble territory. Free market forces again said it was time to take a break. Instead, Wall Street dreamed up the secondary market for subprime mortgages, selling junk to unsuspecting bond investors in all corners of the world. The real estate market soon reached outer space. Builders went hog wild and built enough houses to satisfy demand for decades to come. In the period 2006-08, the market finally collapsed. Free market forces said it was finally time to pay the price. As we can see by the recently released FOMC transcript, the Fed governors were so far out in left field, they may not even have been in the ballpark. Policymakers were and are still clueless. Their ignorance resulted in a period of mass confusion, and they missed the golden opportunity to limit the damage of the Greenspan errors. 2008, post Lehman Brothers, was the start of the era of insane intervention. Every branch of government decided to pull out all the stops. Builders were given free money via tax loss carry-forwards and were encouraged to build more and more future foreclosures. Buyers were given tax credits. Bernanke said, drop those rates to zero, while he printed and printed and printed. In the meantime, Geithner said he would use taxpayers' funds to guarantee everything, resulting in the 90% dominance of government mortgage lending we have in place today. Attorneys General said no foreclosures were possible because, well, there should be no foreclosures. A decade of disastrous public policy has turned the molehill into the Himalayas. Furthermore, there is no doubt that demographics have changed. Overall demand for housing is no longer the same as it was when the baby boomers were in their most productive years. How can we use housing data of the last 10 years and apply them to projections for the next 10 years? In order for real estate to have a true bottom, endless rounds of interventions would have to be removed from the free market. We know that is not going to happen. If the market hiccups, Bernanke is standing by with QE3. The administration is readying massive re-election plans by refinancing anyone who is underwater, by principal reductions and giveaways of foreclosed properties. Greece is showing the world that it is quite easy to be hooked on crack and not so easy to get off. Is there any doubt that the real estate market would crash immediately if Geithner were to stop guaranteeing loans and Bernanke stopped loading up the Fed's balance sheet? Has real estate really hit bottom? I think the market is on life support. Why don't we re-examine the patient once all the feeding tubes have been removed? All right, ladies and gentlemen, we've come to our point of halfway, as it were, and I think we'll take our break, and then I'll be right back. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're back. And let's kick off the second half here with an email from Steve Kruger, who says, Richard, on February the 20th, show, you read an email from Joanne, who was rightly concerned about the lack of intellect, stupidity, of the general public. Well, she need not worry. America's school system is doing exactly what it is supposed to do. That is, to provide Americans with a marginal education that allows us to recognize our names in print, but little else. We are not taught fractional reserve banking, nor anything about the Federal Reserve. We actually graduate high school barely able to make change of a dollar. When you think about it, if your plans as a government are to wrap your citizens in chains and rob them blind, then why not keep the youth as uninformed as possible? For the last 30 years, education has been getting worse every year. So, Joanne, school has gotten so bad that schools resemble prison more than halls of learning. I think it was Lenin and Hitler who said, give me the youth of a nation and I'll take over without firing a shot. Also, how many times have you been on a checkout line and the person in front of you is told by a young cashier his bill is $15.40, and he hands the cashier $20.40, expecting a $5 bill in return, only to have the cashier tell him, I can't do that, and gives him a look like, what, are you nuts? This has happened so often, I've just given up and deal with the coins. The children of today don't have a chance, as they are held captive by a system that worsens every year. Sadly, in this mess of dumbed-down kids, are our future congressmen and presidents. So what chance do we really have to turn the country around? Not much. Steve Kruger. And Steve adds another email saying, Richard, our debt measured against the GDP number that is arrived at by a government statistician amounts to nothing more than liar's loans of gargantuan proportions. If a person had the real percentage of debt that the nation has, I do think it would be time to concede leaving your clothes and ID on a bridge with a note stating, this is the only way out, I have no choice, and take the leap. Someone holding a lot of US debt is going to get screwed. That's what wars are about. Steve Kruger. Yes, Steve, thank you. I never feel like commenting on your emails. They really do speak for themselves. They are powerful, pithy, and the of all. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you again, Steve Kruger, for that. Well, $100 billion down, $40 trillion left, though, more or less. This week, European sages cut another deal to stave off the truth. Instead of defaulting openly and honestly, as Greece has done over and over again ever since 1827, the Greeks will be rescued. According to Loukas Papademos, the technocrat leading Greece through its veil of deceit, quote, it's no exaggeration to say that today is a historic day for the Greek economy, end of quote. He's right. It's no exaggeration. It's an outright lie. What's historic about the 15th rescue? And as soon as the Greeks are fished out of the water, they're to be given a shave and a haircut. No kidding. They're supposed to shave off more public employees, more spending, and more benefits. Already, one of five people is out of a job, with two out of five unemployed among young people. In November alone, 126,000 Greeks lost their jobs, the equivalent of 3.5 million job losses in the U.S. in a single month. But the Greeks aren't the only ones who are suffering. Their creditors are supposed to suffer a $100 billion haircut, too. Sounds like a default to me. And what's important about Greece's sixth major default on its foreign billion debt? It defaulted for the first time in 1827. Since then, it's made a habit of it. And the important thing from our point of view is that the Europeans are deleveraging, getting rid of debt, at least a little, around the periphery of Europe. But as Bill Bonner says, the trouble is there's a whole lot more. And the level of debt generally is still increasing, thanks to the very same officials who just cut the latest Greek debt deal. If you have debt equal to 100% of your income, you can probably handle it. If the interest rate is 5%, you devote 1/20th of your revenue to debt service. But if your debt goes to 200% of your income, the burden of the past begins to weigh on the future. You have to cut spending and investing because so much of your income must be used to pay for things that have already been produced and consumed. Growth slows. The economy groans. At 5% interest, you'd have to devote a full 10% of your income just to pay the interest. At 10%, you're in real trouble. With one of every $5 already spoken for, even before you get it. The world produces about $50 trillion worth of output per year. Some countries, usually poor ones, have very little debt, for the simple reason that no one would lend them money. Others, such as the UK and the Netherlands, have total debt burdens over 500% of GDP. Much of it is mortgage debt, which is a special case, since it may be considered an ongoing expense, a substitute for rent. Even at 200% of GDP, debt doesn't have to be a permanent and irreducible drag. If the economy grows faster than the debt, the burden becomes lighter over time. This is what happened in the U.S., for example, after World War II, and again during the Clinton years. The problem now, grosso modo, is that the growth is in the countries with little debt, and the debt is in countries with little growth. In the U.S., for example, debt increases 2 to 3 times faster than GDP. Most of the developed world is not so different from Greece. Some have more debt, some have less. Overall, they have government debt equal to 100% of GDP. Household debt adds another 200% of GDP or more. The typical developed country has total debt somewhere around 300% of GDP. Total GDP is about $40 trillion. So in order to get total debt even down to 2 times GDP, they need to wipe out $40 trillion of debt. Well, you know, talking about Greece, if you really want structural reform, a lot of that is going to have to come from new blood. Northern European entrepreneurs and corporations setting up in Greece to take advantage of the large supply of low cost of labor there, as well as all the advantages of being both in the EU and in the Mediterranean. But that's not going to happen as long as you read stories like this one about how it took 10 months to get permission to launch a website selling olive oil-based products to the U.S. market. Fotis Antonopoulos and his partners spent hours collecting papers from tax offices, the Athens Chamber of Commerce and Industry, the municipal service where the company is based, the health inspector's office, the fire department, and banks. At the health department, they were told that all the shareholders of the company would have to provide, get this, chest x-rays and, in the most surreal demand of all, stool samples. Once they climbed the crazy mountain of Greek bureaucracy and reached the summit, they faced the quagmire of the bank, where the issue of how to confirm the credit card details of customers ended in the bank demanding that the entire website be in Greek only. When politicians talk about structural reform in Greece, they mean cutting out a lot of this kind of red tape. But that takes time, which Greece doesn't have. Besides, you need some kind of financial system to support new businesses. And Greece's banks are barely lending at this point. The really big picture here is that European Monetary Union is a marriage and not a happy one right now. In any marriage, if one partner falls on hard times, it's incumbent upon the other to support them. If they can't or won't, then divorce is surely on the cards. Similarly, if one partner doesn't trust the other, then the marriage will not last long. The latest Greek bailout is being sold with the idea that Europe will support Greece indefinitely and trust Greece to do everything that's promised. Neither passes the laugh test. And so, rather than moving to Greece to help rebuild its economy, the rest of Europe will ultimately split up with its non-contiguous partner. Frankly, the only question is when. All right, well, let me talk for a few moments about the much vaunted corporate profits, which have been hitting all-time highs recently. Now, I've mentioned the laying off of personnel in the past and the offshoring of corporations to rehire people at a tenth of the cost of doing so in the United States. What I have failed to mention, however, is the phantom nature of these profits. They are artifacts of currency devaluation, not an increase in efficiency or production of goods and services. Though few people talk about it, the large global US-based corporations are now dependent on non-US sales for about 40% of their revenues, with 50% and up for many companies, and virtually all their profit growth. Overseas sales are made in the local currency, the euro, yen, renminbi, Australian dollar, Canadian dollar, and so on, and the profits are stated in US dollars on corporate profit and loss statements. In 2002, 1 euro of profit earned by a US global corporation equaled $1 in profit when converted into US dollars. That same 1 euro profit swelled to $1.60 in 2008 as the US dollar depreciated against the euro. That 60 cents of profit was phantom, an artifact of the depreciating dollar. It did not result from a higher production of goods and services or greater efficiencies. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is why profits earned in non-US markets have risen so dramatically, even as domestically earned profits have stagnated. The US dollar has declined dramatically against the currencies of America's major trading partners, boosting phantom profits across the board when the non-US profits are converted to US dollars on corporate profit and loss statements. The strengthening dollar is putting these vast phantom profits at risk. Were the US dollar to return to its 2002 relative value in other currencies, virtually all the profits Forex generated, corporate profits, that have justified the stock market rally will vanish. And I do believe, as many of you know, that the dollar is about to rally very significantly vis-a-vis other currencies. So, there you have it. Well, a quick email from Kevin Moran, who says, Richard, the European Union has been successful in pushing this crisis forward yet again. My read of this information is that we could be seeing an end to this can-kicking as soon as April 2012, but maybe nothing of significance will happen before September the 30th. Any thoughts? Kevin Moran. Kevin, I do think that an event out of left field will appear dramatically and unexpectedly at any point. I feel that that will take care of all these problems and that we will come crashing back to earth with a very, very sharp bump indeed. I don't think one can time it, and I think it's a mistake to try. But it certainly is very frustrating for those of us who are really waiting for this to happen, not because we want it to happen, but because we know it must. And must it will. So, Kevin, keep the faith. Patience is a virtue, as they say, and virtue is a grace, and grace is a little girl who never washed her face. Sorry about that. Had to add it in. Anyway, let's turn our attention to that ugly institution, the National Association of Realtors. You know, their data reporting blows my mind. I'm not sure why any news source who expects to be treated with any kind of respect even bothers to report the data anymore. And I quote, sales of existing homes jumped more than 4% in January. Home sales hit 2-year high in January. Just two of the headlines out there. So, let's look at the magic of simple arithmetic to see how this so-called gain in existing home sales was calculated. In December 2011, the existing home sales number was reported to be 4.61 million annualized, up 5% from November. The existing home sales number for January 2012 was just reported at 4.57 million. Simple math would say home sales dropped, right? The NAR conveniently revised down the December number from 4.61 million to 4.38 million, thereby enabling it to report a very headline-friendly 4% gain from December to January. They pulled the same trick in December from November. Of course, none of the headlines will ever reference this fact, and everyone who just looks at the headline reports will come away with the impression that existing home sales are recovering in robust fashion. The NAR has methodically shaped the perception of most people who actually follow the news. And to be honest, I wouldn't have a problem with an occasional downward revision with data like this. But with the NAR, it has become systematic and methodical. It enables them to deliberately control perception of the housing market for the masses who don't pay attention to the truth. I'm sure all of you are aware that the NAR recently revised lower all existing housing sales as reported from 2007 through October 2011 by 14%. Ladies and gentlemen, think about that for a minute. It means that over 7 out of every 100 home sales reported over a nearly 5-year time span was total bullshit. They didn't exist. Poof. Think about the implications of that. Housing market finance businesses and realtors got rich off that fraud because the NAR systematically created a perception of relative strength in the housing market that never existed. Hundreds of thousands of people likely bought homes during that period because they sincerely thought the housing market was healthy and a good investment based on this data. The NAR is a total fraud. In fact, nearly all of the official source economic data that is reported in the United States is fraudulent. One good way to test the NAR numbers is to watch the mortgage application data from the Mortgage Bankers Association. It's skewed by the fact that people often file more than one application to shop deals, but in general, I believe the trend over several months is indicative of the real condition of the housing market. That number just so happened to be reported earlier last week. By the way, every Wednesday at 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, it showed a 2.9% decrease in mortgage purchase applications week to week, ending last week. The 4-week moving average is down 3.2%, and the index is down about 12% from a year ago. Well, obviously, this paints a completely different picture of the housing market from the one presented by the National Association of Realtors and its Prozac-addled chief economist, Lawrence Dunn. Oh, by the way, the headline is reported by the NAR is, "Existing home sales rise again in January." I think that headline, in the context of what I've just been talking about, speaks for itself. George Orwell must be smiling from his grave today. All right, let me take another email from Gilbert. I see we've got no emails in. "Dear Richard, the U.S. government is a parasitical entity on the well-being of almost all of the American people. It is so blinded by the greed and self-interest of itself and its partners in crime, the big banks, corporations, and security organizations, and military industrials, that it's lost track of the fact that it's a parasite and needs to keep the host alive." Who thought the USSR would fragment 3 months before it did? Gilbert? Okay, thank you, Gilbert. I'm very pleased and gratified that you have written that to me. Consider these fascinating bullets from Gallup. "Conservative states are considerably more religious than liberal learning states, and this correlation between religion is increasing. Conservative states are also less educated than liberal ones. This correlation between conservative affiliation and education, percentage of adults who are college graduates, is also substantially higher than before. States with more conservatives are less diverse. Conservative political affiliation is highly negatively correlated with the percentage of the population that are immigrants or gay and lesbian. There is no correlation to race or ethnicity. However, whether measured as a percent white, percent black, or percent Hispanic, fascinating. Conservative political affiliation is strongly correlated with the percentage of the state's workforce in blue-collar corporations, occupations, I mean. Conservative political affiliation is highly negatively correlated with the proportion of workforce engaged in knowledge-based professional and creative work. States with one more conservatives are considerably less affluent than those with more liberals. Conservative political affiliation is highly negatively correlated with state income levels and even more so with average hourly earnings. Well, there we have it. All right. Well, now, ladies and gentlemen, many of you know the high esteem in which I hold Bill Bonner, whose Daily Reckoning I've read personally every day since its inception in 1998. Well, it may interest you to know that Bill is taking his very first break since starting up 14 years ago. A two-month sabbatical from writing his daily column starting tomorrow. So I thought I'd finish today by reading you his final piece before he departs. And here we go, and I quote, "Sometimes it seems as if the whole progress of the 20th century has been used to remove the impediments to catastrophe. Good sense, prudence, tradition, rules, principles, and the lessons learned at such great costs over so many centuries, like unread copies of The Wealth of Nations or The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, they are tossed into the trash bin. No stain of history is left on the spotless mind of the new century. The new century began with George W. Bush's preemptive war doctrine, contradicting everything nations had learned over at least 2,000 years. Even the Romans knew better than to go to war unprovoked. Not that the attacker can't win from time to time, but an aggressor nation sets the gods against itself. Eventually, it's punished, often brutally. We saw that as recently as seven decades ago, when the aggressor nations of World War II, Germany, Italy, and Japan, were crushed. But now the United States is the aggressor. Can good guys be bad guys? We don't know. But we think we see the gods edging over to the other side. So, too, was it long established that the rule of law was more comfortable and agreeable than the rule of men? Law was predictable. Law was fair. Men were given to prejudice, perfidy, and power struggles. Especially in a matter as important as war, the highest authority in the U.S., the Constitution, makes it clear that the law must be followed. Congress had to consider, debate, and decide. But that law went out the window long ago. In the 21st century, it was forgotten altogether. Now the president can decide for himself how and when to waste the nation's treasure and the lives of its young men and women. Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Sudan, Pakistan. Where were the declarations of war? Who needs them? Besides, they just got in the way of catastrophe. And what about habeas corpus? Oh, that's gone too. Established hundreds of years ago to protect citizens from the arbitrary power of their own government. Habeas corpus is, well, history. Now, the president can decide who lives and who dies, who gets sent to jail, and who lives at taxpayer expense. But our beat is money. And in the world of money, too, the constraints that kept people from going into bankruptcy and ruin have been removed. Once government leaders were ashamed of deficits. Now they're proud of them. Once economists, finance ministers, and heads of households tried to avoid debt. Now they welcome it. Once a central banker who created money out of thin air had his private parts cut off. Now his manhood grows with the money supply. Once a banker who lent money at less the inflation rate was regarded as a fool. Now he's seen as a hero. Once we were happy, young, handsome, and now, oh, never mind. That's all for us. We're headed for the hills. And ladies and gentlemen, please stay tuned for Johnny Miller and the expat files following immediately after this. And that concludes our show for today. Have a great weekend. I'll be back on Monday. As usual, this is Richard Martin saying, bye-bye, go ahead.